This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Konnichiwa, amigos. Today we have Donald Hoffman on the show. For those of you guys that aren't familiar with Donald, he is a professor in the Department of Cognitive Sciences at the University of California, Irvine, cognitive psychologist, author, speaker. If you guys haven't checked out his TED Talk, Do We See Reality As It Is? I highly recommend it. And we get to talk about some of the probably trippiest things I've ever got a chance to talk with a guest about, which is the fact that we don't see reality as it is, and the possibilities of the fact that we might be living in a simulation. We also got to go over psychedelics and how that could alter the realities that we live in, the definition of being conscious, and what consciousness means, and whether there's an afterlife and how that ties into the spiritual beliefs that a lot of people have been taught to believe. So it gets deep, guys. This is our longest conversation that I've ever had on Growth Minds with a guest. It ran 2 hours long, and I would grab a cup of tea, cup of coffee. Some of you guys may want to smoke some weed and dig into this conversation with Donald Hoffman. Donald Hoffman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me, Sean.
Excited to have you on. A little bit nerve-wracking just based on some of the research that I've done about how deep you go into around, you know, the space-time and consciousness and all of these things that probably a lot of people think about but haven't really conceptualized as much as you have. How does one even start this pathway of digging into something as, you know, probably as profound as sharing with the people that reality is not what it seems like? I mean, where do you even originate that idea, and how do you decide to go into this path?
Right. So I think most of us just assume that when I look at an apple and I see the red color and the apple shape and so forth, that, I'm saying the truth, that there really is an apple that exists, and it would exist even if I weren't looking. And, you know, we don't believe that we're seeing all of the truth, but that we see those aspects of reality that we need to survive. And if I look up at the moon and you look up at the moon, we're looking at something that existed long before we ever looked, and will exist long after we're dead, and we're seeing a reality, not all of it again, but a genuine reality. The shape is right, the color is right, and so forth that we're seeing. And the intuition that most of us would have, if we have a little bit of scientific background, maybe about evolution and so forth, an argument might be that, if you see the truth, if you see reality as it is, at least those aspects of reality that you need, then you're going to be more fit than those who don't see those aspects of reality. And so, in each generation, those who saw reality a little bit more accurately in the ways that were needed probably, were more successful at feeding, fighting, fleeing, and mating, the big, important actions of life. And so they were more likely to pass on their genes that code for more accurate perceptions. And so, based on that kind of intuitive logic, it makes sense that after, thousands of generations of that, we've been really shaped to see truths, the truths that we need. And so, You know, that's an intuitive attitude that a lot of people would have. And in fact, it's the attitude that most scientists, I mean, who are actually experts in evolutionary theory. I mean, what I've outlined there is, you know, an informal statement of the kinds of arguments that they will give formally, that evolution has shaped us to see reality as it is, because that will make us more fit, you know, more able to, you know, compete in feeding, fighting, fleeing, and mating.
And the idea is that it's important for survival, because if we thought we looked at a rock, or so we looked at a tiger, let's say, and we thought it was a rock, it just would mean that we were dead, basically.
Right, because you might want to pick up a rock and throw it, but if you try to pick up a tiger and throw it, you might have something else coming at you. So
that's right.
So absolutely, it makes sense, and you might go, that's so obvious, is, you know, why think about it any further? It's just obviously true that, you know, we had to be shaped to see the truth. Not, of course, no one thinks we see all of the truth, but those mm-hmm. truths that we need for our species to survive. Well, so I decided now, you know, 14, 15 years ago, to really look at that carefully. Right? And by that, I mean, we all have an intuitive notion about evolution, but it turns out that intuition has been turned into mathematics. A guy named John Maynard Smith, a British mathematician in the 1970s, used something called game theory, the mathematics of game theory, wedded that with evolutionary theory, and came up with evolutionary game theory. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that we can actually not run simulations of evolution, and also prove theorems about evolution by natural selection. And so I got a couple of graduate students who wanted to get their PhDs interested in this, and they ran simulations. And the simulations suggested that organisms that saw reality as it is could never outcompete organisms that saw none of reality, organisms of equal complexity that saw none of reality and were just tuned to the fitness payoffs, right? To the consequences of their actions. And so doing those simulations gave us some insight into why that was the case. Part of the reason is that it takes a lot of time and energy to compute the truth. And if you don't compute the truth, you don't have to waste that time and energy. But even more deeply, it was that fitness payoffs, the things that actually govern whether you survive or not, seemed to be erasing information about the structure of the world. So I went to a mathematician, Chetan Prakash, you know, with the simulations, the results, and the ideas. And I proposed a couple ideas about theorems that might be true based on the simulations. And so he's the real mathematician. I'm not, but I knew enough math to get into trouble and not enough to get out of trouble. But he knew enough to actually prove a couple really important theorems. And so the bottom line is this. It's a theorem of evolution by natural selection that the probability is precisely zero that any structure that you perceive, whether it's the structure of shapes or colors, any structure of your perceptions, the probability is zero that structure that you perceive in any way represents a structure of objective reality. So whatever objective reality is, you know, so for now, I don't know what objective reality is, right? But suppose there is an objective reality, it's got some structure. What is the probability that natural selection would shape our sensory systems or any organism's sensory systems to tell some truths about that structure, the truths that organism might need? And the answer is the probability is precisely zero, mathematically zero. So that's the stunning result. So evolution is not a hand wave. It's not, I have my opinion about it. You have your opinion about it. No, it's a mathematical theorem. And so it's a mathematical theory. And so, you know, we can prove theorems. And so that's the remarkable theorem. And so it raises an obvious question, right? You know, how in the world is perception going to help us stay alive if it's not showing us the truth about the world, right? And then, you know, how could that be? It seems so counterintuitive. And the answer, I think, is perhaps best understood by a metaphor. And there's a couple of metaphors, I think, that are helpful. One is if you're using a computer with a Windows desktop, right, and you have nice little icons on your desktop and so forth for files or images or whatever it is that you're working with, you know that if you have this blue rectangular icon in the middle of your desktop for, say, a book that you're writing or an article that you're writing, the article itself in your computer is not blue and rectangular and in the middle of the computer, even though the icon on your desktop is blue and rectangular in the middle of your desktop. And in that metaphor, the reality is like all these voltages and magnetic fields and, you know, circuits inside this computer that you may or may not even know about, or you may have no expertise in. And what you see is not circuits and software. You just see eye candy, simple eye candy that lets you control all those circuits without even understanding them at all, right? And the point of a user interface is to let you control reality without even knowing what the reality is. Most people have no idea about, you know, digital circuits and how they work. Mm-hmm. And for good reason, right? It's just really, really complicated. And in fact, if you had to toggle voltages, like to write an email, right, no one would ever hear from you. So the point is that you can see that knowing the truth, being forced to deal with reality, may not be a help. It could be a hindrance. If I said the only way that you can send me an email is by toggling voltages, well, good luck. It's not going to happen. But if I give you a nice, simple user interface, then it's easy, and you don't have to know anything about reality. And that's what evolution did. What these theorems are telling us is that the selection pressures from evolution are uniformly against forcing us to see the voltages and forcing us to toggle the voltages of reality, whatever they might be. Instead, it's giving this a user interface with simple eye candy and ear candy and touch candy. You know, all of our senses are just user interfaces, not the truth. So it's not just vision, it's all senses and for all organisms, not just humans. This is a universal theorem for all sensory systems of all organisms. We've all been shaped to have, you know, specific user interfaces that let us survive in our niche. So it's another metaphor would be like if you're playing a virtual reality video game, say a virtual reality version of something like Grand Theft Auto. So you see a virtual Mustang, a red Mustang or a green Ferrari or something like that. You see your virtual steering wheel and so forth. And so you have all this nice eye candy that lets you play the game. And if you're really good at that game, then you can beat other people. But you can ask, suppose someone says, well, I'm going to play the game by toggling voltages in the supercomputer. Well, good luck. I mean, I'm going to be able to change lots of voltages in real time by just turning my steering wheel. You're going to have to toggle them one at a time. You have to know what you're doing too. So good luck. You're going, even though you know the truth, you're not going to win the game. And that's sort of what evolution has done. It's given us the tools to win the game. It's a virtual reality headset. So space-time and objects are like a VR headset that lets us play the game of life and win or not. I mean, 99% of all species that have ever existed are extinct. So eventually we all lose.
We'll get back to that. So I like the example of the virtual reality and the fact, Grand Theft Auto is probably one where a lot of people know of, where they can control where the character goes, what they see. And those are like visual elements, I guess kinetic movements and stuff like that. Whereas like this cup or this computer in front of me or this camera in front of me, there's more layers to it, right? There's things I can smell, this coffee. There's a sensory, there's an additional sensory. I can touch it. I can feel it. I can see it from different angles. It seems to me, at least, this seems to be objectively, if that's the right definition, real as I'm seeing it now than a virtual reality game. So I guess my question is, what we're seeing, if what you're seeing right now is what we're seeing today is not the truth, or what we're actually seeing is false, how false is it? How close are we to true reality? Are we actually seeing?
Well, The answer is going, so I should say how I'm thinking about this whole thing as a scientist, right? Ultimately, I don't know anything, right? We have theories, scientists have theories, and we can tell you what our theories mean. And so what we do is we tell you what the best current theories that scientists have mean. So evolution by natural selection is one of our best current theories, right? Well, there's no better theory to explain lots of biological phenomena. It's truly a powerful theory. It's got its own limitations, but we don't have anything better. And so my answer to your question is, using evolutionary theory, the answer is very, very clear. That theory says that no aspect of our perceptions reveals anything about objective reality. None at all. Now, I'm not saying that evolutionary theory is correct. I'm just saying we don't have a better theory, and that's what that theory entails. Now, as a scientist, my attitude is what we're trying to do is really take our best scientific theories, push them to their limits, and find out where they break. And if we can break a theory, that's time to break out the champagne, because now you're ready to take the next step. And by analyzing how the theory, breaks down or gives you conclusions that you think might not be right, then that might give you hints about how to take the next step, right? So our best theories in science will tell us where they stop. They can go this far and no farther, but they can't tell us what we need to do next, right? They just can't tell you what the next step. So that's where we need scientific creativity. So when I say, in answer to your question, that evolutionary theory tells us that none of our perceptions in any aspect tell us anything about objective reality. I can look at that and say, okay, that's what the theory of evolution by natural selection entails. And there's a couple of things I can do about it, a couple of reactions I can have to that. So one reaction might be this. There's a lot more to evolution than natural selection, right? So there's genetic drift, right? There's just random drift of genes. There's things called pleiotropy and sort of linkage. And so there's lots of things that go on in evolution besides natural selection. And there are some evolutionary biologists who think that natural selection is a fairly minor aspect of evolution.
What are some of those? Can we just go very briefly into some of the other two main ones other than natural selection people think about?
The big one would be like genetic drift. And this is a debate, by the way. This is not settled. Experts in the field have differing opinions. But there are some who will say that natural selection plays a really minor role in the current set of genes that we have. It's mostly genetic drift. In other words, there's just random things happen to your genes and they just get passed on randomly without much selection effect on them. So, and for most people will say there is some effect of genetic drift. And so you have the adaptationists who think that there's a lot of emphasis on natural selection, and those who think that no, they're not adaptationists. They think natural selection is fairly minor. And so they'll say, genetic drift plays a bigger role. Linkage is that certain genes are sort of together on chromosomes. And so if one gets passed on, the other is likely to get passed on as well. So you get, they hitchhike along together. And so you get effects like that affect your body and your fitness. That's linkage.
What's an example of that?
There's tons of examples I'll put it this way. Every gene in your chromosome is next to other genes, right? You have 26 chromosomes. I'm sorry, 23 chromosomes, and the genes for eye color, for example, will be next to other genes that may be code for something else, something other aspect of your body. So anytime a particular part of a chromosome gets copied, nearby parts will likely get copied with fractions or the totality of other genes. And so that's called linkage. And pleiotropy is the idea that a given gene might have multiple effects. In fact, most genes, it's really complicated. Genes have many, many different effects. And so selection pressures are again complicated at best, you know, and hard to understand. It's much like, you know, neural networks. You don't know what any particular node is doing in terms of the whole processing of the whole network. It's not just doing one thing. It's contributing to a wide variety
of variables.
Right. So it may be that genes are more like, you know, top level, like nodes in a neural network. They have lots of different effects. So my response on that one is that, and by the way, that's a response that's been given to me by people who are experts in biology, is that it's absolutely true that natural selection may be, for all I know, a minor part of evolution. I mean, and maybe, you know, genetic drift, linkage, pleiotropy, and other things, you know, also constraints from just physics and chemistry may play big roles in it. But here's the point. When we talk about why our perceptions might be true, it's because truer perceptions will make us more fit. And that's a natural selection argument. No one says that genetic drift will make you see the truth. It couldn't. No one says that linkage or pleiotropy will make you see the truth. I mean, that you have some heavy lifting to do to make a story that shows how linkage and pleiotropy are going to make you see the truth. And so what I focused on with my students and Chetan Prakash, my collaborator, is that one aspect of evolution that people do point to when they say we've been shaped to see the truth, namely natural selection. And evolutionary game theory allows me to focus on that one aspect quite clearly and see what it says. And it says the probability is zero that we've been shaped to see the truth. Now, you did point out in your question that we deeply believe that what we're seeing is the truth, right? With the shape, the smell, the color, it all feels very, very compelling to us. And it absolutely, it turns out that we're shaped to believe that very early on in life. About the time you're 4 months of age, you get what's called object permanence. This was first discussed by the developmental psychologist Piaget. He thought it was around 18 months. And he said that before 18 months of age, a child, you look at a baby doll, and the baby doll exists for you as long as you're looking at it. But when you look away, you cease to believe that it exists. And one bit of evidence that he'd give for it would be you show a baby doll to a baby, and they play with it. Now, while they're watching, you put the doll behind a pillow, and they proceed to do something else. But after 18 months, you put the doll behind a pillow, and then they go behind the pillow to get the doll, right? They know that even though they can't see the doll still exists. That's, we called that object permanence. And later experiments were more careful, were more sensitive to what children can really understand. And they found that even at about four months of age, we get object permanence. So think about it from this point of view. We all deeply believe in object permanence. Why? Because when we were 4 months of old, 4 months of age, we were not in any position to argue. Evolution programmed us to believe that. And so as adults, that's the water we swim in. From the time we're 4 months of age, we've just been programmed to believe our interface. And so that's why it's so hard for us to let go. It's not because there are rational arguments that we've sat down and looked at and go, oh, wow, yeah, that's a proof that objects really do exist. No, it's because we believe that since before we could even argue against it. That's just the way we see the world. So that's why this is so counterintuitive to us, not because we've had rational arguments that have proved to us that objects don't exist or objects do exist when we don't perceive them, but rather that evolution just programmed us to believe it. Because, you know, from the evolutionary point of view, there's no percentage in you not believing your perceptions. Just believe them. So you're programmed to believe them. So that's why it's so hard for us intuitively to grasp this. Now, I'm looking for a deeper theory in which evolution would come out as a special case. And maybe for a deeper theory of objective reality, first I can show that the dynamics of this deeper theory looks like evolution by natural selection in our interface, so that I can get back. So I'm not going to – right, when you make a new step beyond the current science – you do not throw away your previous theories. For example, when we went from Newton physics, Newtonian physics, to relativity, we're not throwing away Newton. We're just understanding Newton in a broader context, right? And we still use Newton, and we understand what's so beautiful about Newton's theory. And we still use Newton's equations for a lot of everyday work. It's really important. So even though we now understand that there's a much deeper notion of space and time, namely Einstein's theory of special relativity and general relativity, nevertheless, we don't throw away Newton. And that's the spirit in which we make new steps in our theories. Now, of course, if a theory is just flat out stupid, we throw it away. But I'm not thinking that evolution by natural selection is flat out stupid by any means. So whatever deeper theory I want to propose, I better show how when I project that back into our user interface, it looks like evolution by natural selection. But maybe this deeper theory would make it possible for us to at least see some or perceive some truths of objective reality. So that's sort of the important reason to say that is to just give a feel for how science works, that we take our best theories, not as the gospel, just as the best theories that we have so far, and we use them to solve problems. We try to find their limits. We try to break them. And when we do break them, we try to figure out, a postmortem to figure out what's wrong.
Yeah.
Then try to take the next step where now you have to make a creative leap. You know, the theory may give you ideas about where to go next, but you really have to be taking a creative leap. You know, Einstein took a huge creative leap beyond Newton, right? He said the speed of light is universal. That's huge. You and I, no matter how fast you're going, light will always go away from you at the speed of light. That's crazy, right? From a Newtonian point of view, what is he smoking, right? It's just crazy. But he took that leap. And it worked. And so that's what we will need to do, to have a leap that looks crazy, perhaps, in the current scientific framework, but that gives us back the current scientific framework. You know, like Newton, you can show that in some sense you get back Newton as an approximation to Einstein's theory when the speed of light is taken to go to infinity, right, where the speed of light is not finite. It goes to infinity, then you get something that looks like Newton coming out of Einstein. So you can see how they're related. And so maybe there's a way to rescue the idea that we perceive some truths if we can come up with a deeper theory and show how evolution by natural selection is just a special case of this deeper theory.
Right, right. And I think it's important to give people an idea of how you as a scientist approach your level of thinking so that they don't think you're just putting out random stuff. There's a system and a formula in terms of the way you're formulating this. And I guess ultimately you are looking for ways to debunk this idea that you guys may have, which would be able to poke holes and that would allow you guys to go back to the table of rethinking that. So basically what you're saying is like you're making this thesis that natural selection is a primary way that we have evolved, like I guess the Darwinian. And based on that information, you're making these claims, but I guess this whole thing could be thrown out the door if natural selection turns out not to be the main thing that has helped us evolve over time. Is that right?
That's right. In the following sense that, what seems to be coming out of this theorem from natural selection is that our perceptions evolved to be a user interface, to be a virtual reality headset. That seems to be what it's telling us. And so if that's what it's telling us, then it's saying that what you're seeing isn't the truth. It's just a headset. And it can't tell us what's beyond the headset. That's the point. So evolution can't tell us what's beyond the headset. It can just tell us, you thought you were, when you look at the moon, you thought you were seeing objective reality. When you look around and you see space and time, perceive things in space and time, you thought that space and time were the final nature of reality. No, it's just the format of your headset. So it's the theory, that's an incredibly powerful insight that the theory gives us, right? It's incredibly powerful. But just telling you that you have headset on doesn't tell you what's on the other side of the headset. Now, So that's where you're right. We have to take, as a scientist, we'll have to then take a creative leap, but it's going to have to, whatever the leap is, it's going to have to explain the origin of the headset, the data structure of the headset, what's going on outside the headset, and then how that, what's going on outside the headset projects into the headset, and why, and when I do that projection, it better be mathematically precise first, so no hand wave, a mathematical model of what's outside space-time headset, mathematical model of how it projects into the headset, and then I better show that it looks like evolution by natural selection. I better get back evolutionary theory as the headset version of what's going on outside the headset. In fact, all of current science, so general relativity, the theory of gravity, quantum field theory, the theory of the quantum, these pillars of science, from this point of view, are explorations of our headset. Science, 99.99% of all science has only been a study of the structure and function of our headset. Science has not yet taken a step outside the headset. Now you might say, look, this is fine for a cognitive scientist to be saying this kind of stuff about evolution and space and time is not fundamental, but look, he's not a physicist. I mean, you get any real physicist on here, he's going to tell you that this is nonsense. Of course, space and time is fundamental. Well, it turns out that the physicists themselves have come to the same conclusion that space-time is not fundamental for very, very different reasons than the evolutionary reason that I've given. They're coming, so what they're saying, and this is the catchphrase that they'll use, space-time is doomed. So if you just Google space-time is doomed, you can find lots of videos where the physicists themselves will tell you, like Nima Arkani Hamed at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, will tell you precisely why they now understand that space-time has had a good run. It's been assumed to be fundamental since at least Newton for many, many centuries, but it's over. There's got to be, space-time has to be only an approximate concept. There's got to be some deeper aspect of reality that's utterly beyond space and time, both. And space and time have to emerge from that deeper thing. What Nima, the physicist Nima Arkani Hamed, is proposing is something called cosmological polytopes and amplitudehedrons. So there are actually mathematical structures that I'm just giving you the names. We won't go into the details, but these are just the names of the structures they're finding. There's no space-time. There's no quantum theory. There are no Hilbert spaces, but they're showing how space-time and quantum mechanics can arise as approximations to these. So we're getting it from all of our big theories, evolution by natural selection, quantum field theory, theory of gravity, Einstein's theory of gravity. They're all telling us that space-time is not fundamental. It's just a data structure. There's something deeper. And none of the theories can tell us what's the deeper thing. And the physicist, like what Nima is doing is he's going, you know, we don't know what the nature of reality is beyond space and time. What he's doing is looking for mathematical structures that can then project back in and give us what we see in space-time. But so he's being guided by the mathematics to try to find these structures. But what is that realm about? No idea. I mean, why does this realm exist? No idea. And so, so that's the state of play, which is really quite exciting. I mean, you might think, well, you know, scientists must be throwing up their hands in despair and going, oh, this is terrible, terrible. Everything that we believe is false. No, that the young scientists are going, fabulous. Because we want to explore further. We want to discover new stuff. And, you know, just because for centuries people believed in space-time doesn't mean it's right. And if we can find out that there's something deeper, it's just a headset, okay, well, let's go find out what's beyond the headset. So there's a lot of excitement in physics. And I think hopefully among biologists, the stuff I'm doing is fairly new. So hopefully among cognitive scientists, biologists, to go beyond the headset.
Yeah, no, it must open up a whole new realm now for young and up-and-coming scientists to really rethink a lot of the previous theories that have been put out there. And it allows them to really have a different perspective because of that. Whether they will figure out the answer or not, just to be able to rethink. And hopefully it will get them in an opportunity to to rethink other things that perhaps were not questioned, as much. Going back to the perception of reality, you know, talking about if we have evolved through natural selection because it helped us survive, and obviously back in the day, every little bit helped because a tiger could get us, a bear could find us and hunt us down in the forest. Another tribe could come grab us into a different tribe. Whereas now, today, we live in a world that isn't really struggling, particularly people that are in developed nations. We have more food than we need, light, energy, happiness, whatever it is. We're not struggling per se in the traditional sense. So taking this into account of natural selection, how does this change the accuracy of our perception of reality moving forward if we were to go forward generations and generations that don't have to struggle as much to survive?
Right. So from this new perspective, I would say it's a great question. And the answer intuitively would be like this. Think about someone who just starts to play Grand Theft Auto for the first time. They make lots of mistakes. They die. They're very frustrated. And what happens is as you get more and more experience with your interface, you begin to understand your interface better. You understand the tricks about how to use your interface effectively. And that's what our species has done. And science has been a huge tool. We discovered this amazing fact about our universe that using mathematical models really is helpful in understanding how to manipulate space and time and objects and so forth. I mean, you write down some equations on a piece of paper. So for example, in the 1800s, Faraday was doing all these experiments with magnets and wires and twitching frog legs, electricity and magnetism, did tons of experiments. And Michael Faraday comes along and looks at his experiments and goes, I can write down some equations for that. And he writes down, Maxwell's equations. So Maxwell writes down Maxwell's equations for Faraday's work. And Maxwell's equations turn out to be why you and I can talk today via Skype from halfway around the world. Those equations gave us new understanding of our user interface that allows us to go to the next level of the game in some sense, right? To play the game and not die. So from this point of view, you can see it just because we've gotten better and better at staying alive and medicine and electronics and so forth doesn't mean we're seeing the truth. From this point of view, we're just getting better at using our interface. It's like a person who was a neophyte at Grand Theft Auto and has now become a pro at Grand Theft Auto, but has no idea about the circuits and software inside, right? He doesn't have to be a computer programmer to be a great player of the game. And that's the point. Being great players of the game of life does not mean that we know what's going on in reality.
Gotcha. And is this mostly our... is this heavily weighed on our visual sensories? Meaning, is it possible that our sense of smell, hearing, touch, taste, things around that doesn't involve our visual perceptions could be more in touch with the real truth of reality than our visual sensories?
Well, yeah, we might... I think that's a great question because we intuitively believe that, even if my eyes are fooling me, I can touch something, right? So, and my touch surely will not mislead me. So maybe, the apple doesn't exist. I might think the apple doesn't exist when I don't look, but if I close my eyes and reach out, I can still grab it and touch it with my hand and confirm that the apple really does exist. And it's a clear implication of this theorem from natural selection, even touch is just a user interface. It's all virtual. And there are, for those who want some kind of help with that, to understand, there's phantom limb phenomena. If you look up phantom limb, so there are, unfortunately, people, for example, who've had an arm cut off, who still feel their arm. They still feel like they have a hand. and they have phantom pains. They can have phantom pains in their hand and phantom experiences of cold, hot, itch, pressure, and pain. And if you say, where does it hurt? And they'll point to empty space and it hurts right there and there's nothing there. And so you're actually constructing, even your experience of touch is a virtual reality that you construct. And this is true of all of our senses. And another example of this, I'll just give you, there's something called synesthesia. So about 4% of humans have synesthesia, which is a different organization of the senses. And I'll just give you a concrete example. A guy named Michael Watson, everything that he tasted on his tongue, he also felt as a three-dimensional object in space with his hands. So mint, when he tasted mint, he would feel a tall, cold, smooth column of glass. He could feel it in 3D, put his hands around it in 3D and feel the temperature, the surface, the smoothness. Angostura bitters, which is something you put in drinks, felt like a basket of ivy. He could feel the leaves, the tendrils, the whole bit. He could feel all around it in 3D. Carol syrup.
Feel it where? Like in his hands or his hands, all over? Right. In his hands. Okay. Right, and it's an invisible thing.
That's right. In space. So here's a case where he was touching and he felt it with his hands, just like you touch it, your keyboard on your computer. He was touching these things with his hands and every taste had a touch. So here's a case where the touch is clearly just a user interface. And by the way, he was a good cook. He had this extra representation of taste in terms of three-dimensional objects, their textures, their weights. He could feel the weight of them, their surface shapes. And so he was a great cook because he could experience sauces in much more subtle ways than perhaps the rest of us can. So again, here's a case where we see clearly touch, it was just a user interface and not the reality.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy, some of these things that I hear about, this connection that we have between our minds and our bodies. I'm sure you've heard of like psychodermatology.
Psychoneuroimmunology?
Psychodermatology. Oh, this is like where... Okay, right. Yeah, this is like... I've heard stories of like hypnotists that can make someone visualize themselves on a beach where there's scorching sun, but they themselves are inside. But afterwards, over time, they'd be able to get a tan and their skin would actually become bronzer. And it's just out of this world. It just doesn't make sense scientifically, but there's stuff like that that apparently exists.
I have no knowledge of that myself. So that's quite interesting, but I haven't studied that. So I can't comment. I can say that there, you know, in terms of the power of the mind and the body, there is something called anosognosia. I won't go with anosognosia. So, there are people who have had a stroke in the right hemisphere that leave them with the left hemiparalysis. And they deny that there's any problem. They don't recognize that they have a paralysis. And so here's a case, but then there are certain manipulations that you can do on the person to help them get out of it. And then when they get out of it, they will tell you that they give you evidence that they knew all along that there was a problem there. But there's a problem of denial that is so deep that they deny the reality, but then you can bring them out of it. So yeah, that's well documented that there, you know, you don't get it so much with the left hemisphere stroke, but you do get it with the right hemisphere stroke.
Yeah, that's crazy. Psychedelics is always something that I've been probably more recently curious about, where when you're on LSD or mushrooms, you seem to have this different alternating perception of reality, I guess, as you see it. And it almost feels like you're entering into a different universe. People probably think, and crazy if for those that haven't done it. People that have obviously can relate to it. Have you given any thought to the perception of reality when and this conjointment of using psychedelics to reach different alternatives of reality? Or do you feel like that's more just in our own heads?
It's an interesting question whether the psychedelics are, because they, in some sense, we hear that they open the doors of perception, right? That was one phrase that's been used. It opens the doors of perception, suggesting that in fact we're getting in touch through psychedelics to a reality beyond the everyday physical world. And then the other point of view is that no, you're just sort of addling the brain, and you know, you do random stuff to the brain, of course you're going to get random stuff happening. But pushing my eye, the whole world seems to bounce around, but you know, the world isn't bouncing around, I'm just pushing on my eye. And I as a scientist, of course, I'll have to, I'm saying that there's a reality beyond space and time. So I can't deny that there's a reality beyond space and time. There is. The question now, of course, I want to be a sober scientist. I want to say that, I want to be open to the idea that certain psychedelic experiences may be giving us some insights into something beyond space and time. Absolutely want to be open to it. I also want to be hard-nosed about it and say, maybe I'm just scrambling my interface, right? So so what I need, so those are the two options, right? A genuine insight into something beyond the interface versus, no, it's just screwing up my interface. So I'm not seeing behind the interface, I'm just screwing up my interface, right? It's like I got a software glitch in my VR headset. That's all I'm doing. I'm doing a software glitch. I'm not actually seeing the circuits and software behind it, right? Those are two very, very different things, right? That could be going on with psychedelics. One is just, no, you just messed up, somehow you messed up your headset a little bit, but no, you're not seeing deeper truth. The other is, no, you're not just messing up your headset, you're actually looking at the voltages that you need to be toggling if you're gonna deal with objective reality. That's what's happening to you. So how do we answer that question? So you posed a really good question. I think the only way as a scientist for us to try to answer that question is to say, look, we can't answer it until we propose a theory of objective reality beyond space and time that's mathematically precise, proposed exactly how that theory maps into our space-time headset, proposed exactly what, within that headset, what do brains correspond to, right? When you take psychedelics, they're affecting your brain. So what does the brain correspond to in the objective reality? The brain is just a user interface symbol. It's an icon on your desktop, right? From this point of view, this is the radical. So if people think I'm saying something that's not that radical, here's what the radical aspect of it. The brain is just another icon in your desktop. Your brain, strictly speaking, causes none of your behavior. It causes none of your conscious experiences. The brain is just what you see when you look inside of skulls. It's just another user interface symbol. Now, there is some objective reality that we're interacting with when we see a brain, but that objective reality is nothing like a brain. It has nothing like neurons. Well, so by the way, I love neuroscience. I've done brain imaging studies. I've published brain imaging studies. I think neuroscience is really important. But when we look in the brain and we see neurons, we can't take it at face value. We're going to have to be far more sophisticated. It's not, I see neurons, that's because there are neurons in objective reality. No. This is a user interface symbol. When I see neural networks, what is that telling me about a much deeper reality that doesn't look like neural networks? It's not even in space and time. So I have to reverse engineer what I see. So in other words, I need more funding for neuroscience, not less. The problem of neuroscience is much, much harder than we ever thought. We thought, I see a neuron, there is a neuron. No. I see a neuron, there's this fundamentally different realm that I'm going to have to understand that projects to what I see as a neuron. I need to understand that whole mapping. So there is a ton of, this is job security for neuroscience, what I'm proposing here. We've, in some sense, the real work of neuroscience is yet ahead of us to understand what in objective reality corresponds to neurons, neural circuits, and neural activity. Once we've got all that, then we can try to answer your question. Because then we'll have a model. So when I take LSD, that particular chemical, what does that correspond to in the objective reality, right? The chemicals are just interface symbols. What is that doing in objective reality? Is that actually just when I have this whole mathematical model of reality, how it maps onto the interface, how the brain looks in that interface, am I just addling the interface? Am I just screwing up the interface? Or am I literally opening a new portal in the interface into objective reality? So your question is a good one, and you can see that I probably won't answer it in my lifetime, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a very, very deep question, but it's exactly the right question.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the only closest thing I can think about in terms of this objective reality, which again is probably, it's probably, there's so many different layers to this, which is, you know, when you're on some sort of psychedelic or perhaps marijuana where it's cognitively messing up your perception of reality, and you have a friend of yours that's filming you right across the room, and in your mind you have this reality of this thing making sense, and you're talking about it, and you feel it, you see something visually, let's say a painting, or it's like very colorful, and then you see the actual footage of the video that your friend took the next day when you're sober, and you realize, oh shit, yeah, this is not my perception, this is not accurate at all. Right. And I guess the question is, like, which one was the real truth? Is it the one that we saw in our sober reality, or is it the one that we were able to tap into using other factors? So it's when you introduce like film and photography that has our, you know, our agreement of like what objective reality is, it, you know, it kind of confuses people.
Right. It sort of deflates you, right? You go, oh, I thought I had these deep, deep insights into the truth, and I was just stoned. And I was incoherent and not to be taken too terribly seriously. And in some sense, I'm saying that that's what's true of us when we're sober. We look at all this. We're sure that this is the truth. And at least according to evolution, nope, this isn't the truth. And we've believed it very, very deeply. And so that should also be a warning to us that when we're stoned, we tend to believe what we're experiencing there. So we have this tendency to just believe whatever it is that we're experiencing. And so we need to be cautious about that.
Yeah. Do you think in your lifetime we'll ever understand what consciousness is at the highest level?
Well, That's what I'm working on right now, and so the short answer is, I think we will make progress. I mean, I'm 65. If I live for 15 years, 15 more years, you know, make it to 80 or something like that, I think we'll make quite a bit of progress in the next 15, 20 years.
How do you define consciousness based on what you know today?
Right. People? Great question. Because the word consciousness can be used for a lot of things, right? It's so the thing that I'm talking about when I talk about consciousness is something very, very simple. Just simple experiences like the taste of chocolate, the smell of garlic, the feeling of a headache, an emotion. I mean, people might use consciousness for all, you know, it has to be some exalted self-aware kind of state or something like that. And that's perfectly fine. But for me, the scientific problems of consciousness are completely present in just what we might think of the simplest sensory experiences, something that I could imagine a rat has. I can imagine that a rat smells cheese and has an experience when it smells cheese and when it eats cheese. And that is where I'm, as a scientist, really want to focus on just the qualitative nature of sensory experiences, how it feels to, you know, have a headache, how it feels to taste chocolate, and so forth. You know, to get an idea, I mean, if I have a robot, and I bang the robot with a hammer on its robotic arm, and the robot is programmed to say, ouch, I'm not inclined to feel empathy for the robot. I'm not too worried. I mean, I may not want to hammer it because I don't want to, you know, ruin the hardware, but I'm not worried about that robot in the sense that I would not do that to a mouse. I would not hit a mouse with a hammer because I really feel like that mouse could feel pain. I think the odds are it would feel pain, and it would be just cruel for me to do it. Whereas, you know, in the case of the robot, you know, I wouldn't want to hammer it just because I don't want to hurt expensive equipment. But if you ask me, is there any moral thing about the pain of the robot? No, no. Now, could we eventually get robots that are sophisticated enough? That's, you know, it's an interesting separate question. But that, I'm just bringing that up to say what I'm talking about here. The very simple experiences, the raw sensory experiences. And now, the standard view has been that space and time are fundamental. There was the Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago. There was only space, time, and energy and matter. That was it. There was no life, much less consciousness. There was no consciousness. Life didn't emerge until hundreds of millions, perhaps billions of years later. And then on that story, consciousness emerged much later than life. And so consciousness is a latecomer on the pre-existing stage of space-time. That's the standard physicalist view. I'm saying that that entire view is false. Space-time is doomed. When we say space-time is doomed, we're saying that that story is not correct. There's a deeper story. That's only an interface story. It's not the deepest story, the deepest scientific story that we can give. Now, I don't know what's outside of space-time. I don't know. I'm taking a creative leap, and I admit that I'm probably wrong, and we'll see. But the leap I'm taking is I'm saying, if space-time isn't fundamental, what is? I don't know. I'm going to try to propose that consciousness is fundamental. And so not just a hand wave of consciousness. I have a mathematical model, and if people are interested in, you know, looking at it, I published a paper called Objects of Consciousness. So if you just Google Objects of Consciousness and Hoffman, you'll find the paper and you can read it for yourself. It's a mathematically precise model of consciousness in which I try to boil down consciousness to its bare bones. What is the minimal thing that I could assert about consciousness that would allow me to boot up a theory of consciousness that gives the full variety of all the complexity of consciousness? So that's what we do in science. We try to come up with the minimal assumptions that can boot up the entire field, right? That's what you don't want to throw in the kitchen sink. You want to, you know, make as few assumptions as possible. So the assumptions I make about consciousness are that there are conscious experiences, like smelling garlic, having a headache, raw, simple conscious experiences, maybe not so simple, seeing red versus not seeing red, something very simple like that. Mm-hmm. That those conscious experiences affect choices. So there's a notion of agency. So I have this thing I call a conscious agent. It has experiences, and those experiences affect choices, and those choices are the only thing they do is to affect the experiences of other agents. That's it. So there are experiences that inform choices. Those choices, all they can do is to affect the experiences of other agents. That's, for those who are interested in mathematics, I have a measurable space of conscious experiences and a Markovian kernel that lets me affect other conscious agents. But think of it this way. It's a vast social network, like the Twitterverse. Each agent is like a Twitter user. And just like you can tweet and follow, these agents, these conscious agents, are having experiences influenced by other agents, and then they are, so they're the ones that they follow are affecting their experiences, and then they tweet out the consequences of their experiences to others, which affect the experiences of others. So it's like the Twitterverse. So I'm proposing that objective, and by the way, again, of course, I'm probably wrong. The whole point of science is you got to go out, be bold, be mathematically precise. And so I've got a mathematical model. We're doing the network. So this is now network dynamics, right? It's like like we have to understand the dynamics of social networks, and it's really complicated. Social networks are really complicated, but there's new math in just the last few decades on how to understand social networks and how misinformation propagates through networks and all sorts of things. That's the mathematics that I'm having to work with, is to understand the dynamics of conscious agents. And here's the idea. First, I'm after, there's no notion of self in my basic definition, right? So I have to show how you could create a self. There's no notion of intelligence. There's just raw experience and simple actions to influence others. So I have to use networks of these agents to build up learning, memory, problem solving, intelligence, a self, all these things that I didn't put into my foundation assumptions. I have to be able to create as networks of conscious agents. So that'll be one evidence of whether I'm onto the right track. Can I actually build these things from the network dynamics? The other thing will be, how do I get space-time and physics and everything that we see inside space-time arising as just a headset? So the idea will be, and I have to do that with mathematical precision. So the idea at top level is this. Think the Twitterverse, right? There are tens of millions of Twitter users, billions of tweets. There's no way that you as a Twitter user could interact with all those users or read all the tweets. It's just overwhelming amount of data. So if you want to get a feel for what's going on in the Twitterverse, what do you do? You have to have a visualization tool, maybe a virtual reality headset that lets you see what's trending in New York versus what's trending in Germany versus what's trending in all of China. Or you may want to, zoom out to all of China, or zoom in to what's happening in Beijing, or zoom into what's happening in a particular user at a particular street inside Beijing, right? So you want a visualization tool that lets you zoom out and zoom in, but the tool, of course, is going to be ignoring most of the details, right? It's going to be looking, for example, at trends. What's trending? And that's going to be the big idea, that space and time and physical objects are just a visualization tool that give us the long-term trends of what's happening in this network of conscious agents. So the objective reality is this vast social network of conscious agents. It's overwhelmingly complicated. There are countless agents. My interface gives me the most direct contact with certain agents. I call them human beings. But when I look at you, right, all I see is skin, hair, and eyes. I don't actually see your consciousness. And if you look at your own face in the mirror, all you see is skin, hair, and eyes. What you know firsthand, that what you see in the mirror is trivial compared to your hopes, your dreams, your aspirations, your love of music. The whole rich world of your conscious experiences is hidden behind this simple, trivial thing that we just call the human face. It's obvious firsthand that the face is a trivial icon. Behind that icon is the rich world of your conscious experiences. I'm saying that that's really true. The objective reality is this rich world of conscious agents with their conscious experiences. Space-time is just a dumbed-down visualization tool that allows us to deal with the overwhelming complexity of consciousness, this whole vast social network of consciousness. When I see a cat, I've got a visualization symbol which has given me less insight into the consciousness that I'm interacting with. I mean, I can tell if my cat likes it, if I'm petting it, or if it likes the food. But in the case of an ant, my interface has given me far less information about the consciousness that I'm feeling. When I get down to a bacterium, it's game over. I have no idea. I mean, I am interacting with the realm of conscious agents, but my interface is giving up. Because of course it has to. That's the whole point of an interface. It simplifies until it finally gives up. When I get down to what I call quantum particles, protons and neutrons and quarks and gluons, I've completely given up. There's no insight into consciousness at all. No surprise, an interface has to dumb things down, and at some point it just gives up, right? And so physicalism is the mistake of taking our interface for the truth.
Why is it the case that the cats, we have less perception of consciousness with let's say ants versus cats? Is that because they have less consciousness in terms of our view of life?
Actually, from this point of view, it's a great question, and the answer is no, not because they have less consciousness. It's because of a limit of our interface. It's not a limit of their consciousness. For all I know, when I see what I call a rock, my interface has given me no insight into life, much less consciousness, right? But I'm interacting with the realm of conscious states. I'm not saying a rock is conscious, by the way. By the way, I'm not saying the human body is conscious. The human body is just an icon. The body literally, specifically in space and time, is not who you are. It's just an icon. So a rock isn't conscious. The human body isn't conscious. These are merely icons that are visualization tools that are pointing to the realm of conscious agents. And for all I know, when I see something that to me looks like a stupid rock, the realm of conscious agents that I'm interacting with is far more brilliant and has a far greater range of experiences than I could ever imagine. In other words, this turns everything on its head. We tend to think of ourselves as sort of the epitome, right, the highest level of consciousness. For all I know, we're just somewhere in the middle, and there are consciousnesses that we can't even understand. In fact, most consciousness that we can't even comprehend, in the following sense, very simple sense. If I ask you, imagine a specific color that you've never seen before. Can you?
Can't.
Right. Right. I've asked a trivial little exercise of your imagination. Just imagine one stupid little color you've never seen before. Can't do it. I'm saying that there's an infinite range or a countless range of possible experiences out there that other agents are having that you and I can't even concretely imagine. That's how rich this universe is. And for all I know, when I'm interacting with the rock, what's on the other side of the interface could be something. If I could come face to face with it, I might just fall down and worship it. You know, who knows? It would just be so profound. But all I see is a rock. So what we have to learn from this new point of view is things that look dumb to me, that's not an insight into the reality. That's a feature of my interface.
Yeah.
So we have to be much more clever. It's much harder work now. Instead of taking what we see at face value, the rock looks dumb, therefore it is dumb. It's rather, no. There's a deeper framework. What is the structure of my interface? What is the data structure here? You know, think in computer science. There's some data structure that I'm using. I'm mapping this deeper reality into this data structure. Just because I get this simple data structure doesn't mean the reality is simple. It depends on what got mapped into it and how much compression. Did I lose a lot of information in that mapping? Then yeah, it looks stupid to me because I lost a lot of information in the mapping. But that's just then a limit of my interface. And I have to be very careful to say that therefore the thing that mapped into it is also stupid and simple. That's a really dangerous move to say that because it looks stupid to me, that it must be stupid. So this makes it much more sophisticated. And that's why I was saying that neuroscience, I mean, this is job security for neuroscience, because we have to actually reverse engineer neural networks and neural circuitry and understand what is telling us about this network of conscious agents. That is some serious work.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like what you're proposing then is what we're seeing potentially could be so far from reality to the point where rocks themselves could be something that we should be potentially worshiping. Yet, I guess where I'm confused at is how can so many, there's certain things that we're, there's universally, well, at least the people that live on this earth are perhaps scared of, or things that we just might ignore. This isn't just me. This is all of humans that would go up to a rock and they'd be far less scared than, let's say, a tiger. But it's not just humans, but it's also dogs or cats or any living animal would be far less scared of a rock than a lion. So there's certain truths that I think people that are at least alive today can all agree on. But it seems like what you're proposing is something that could be so far off that isn't even within our perception. So I guess that's where I'm a little bit confused.
Right. So the idea is that it's not that I would want to worship the rock or that there's something special about the rock. The rock is just my creation, right? That's just part of my headset. It's just a symbol. Mm-hmm. It's another icon on the desktop. My only point is that, I mean, so my icon on the desktop, say, is just blue and rectangular in the middle of my screen. But maybe that icon is pointing to a paper. Maybe it's like Einstein's special theory of relativity paper, right? Well, I mean, the icon looks pretty dumb and stupid. It's just a rectangular blue thing on the middle of my screen. But behind it is this incredible article that is mind-blowing, that tells you about special relativity and light and so forth. And that's the relationship. So I wouldn't worship the icon. It's just blue. But I would recognize that even though the icon looks stupid to me, the paper is not stupid. The paper behind the icon is not stupid. So it's not that the rock is special. It's just that the rock, it looks stupid because that's just the tools I've got. That's my problem. It's my limitation. It's my representation that's dumb. The thing behind the rock, just like the thing behind the blue rectangular icon, could be really, really exalted. Mm-hmm. Now, one thing I will have to explain is, you know, your user interface lets the world affect you, right? But it also lets you affect the world. And so so certain symbols like the rock, I'm getting trivial information about, if I'm right about this network of conscious agents, right? Then it would follow that the rock is giving me trivial information about that network. I have no idea what that network is like from a rock. But it may then also follow, and this is why I need to do the math, that if the interface is such that the rock is giving me trivial access to the world, it also is the case that for most purposes, I can't use the rock to get to that world, right? So if I hammer the rock, I'm not hurting agents, right? I'm not inflicting pain. But again, I need to work that out. And there are cases where I could use that rock. If I took that rock and hit a person with the rock, then I am inflicting pain. But I'm inflicting pain not because of the rock icon per se, but because I'm using that to affect the icon of their body. So certain icons are giving me a portal into consciousness and an ability to affect consciousness. And this is where the mathematics is going to have to be really worked out. But just like in, you know, a virtual reality game like Grand Theft Auto, the icon for the steering wheel and the gas pedal are really important icons. They're what really let me play the game. You know, banging on the dashboard isn't going to do anything for me, right? I mean, that is an icon, but when I bash on it, it doesn't help me drive the car. It doesn't help me brake. It doesn't help me accelerate. So that's sort of the point. A user interface gives us certain symbols that allow us to affect the reality beyond the interface. And that's what we have to work out in this new mathematical model, is exactly what are the accelerators and the steering wheels in our interface? What and how are they affecting this reality? If I'm right about this network of conscious agents, how is it that, you know, what we call physical objects allow us to interact with conscious agents and affect their consciousness?
God, this is just so above my pay grade. I mean, I'm not even going to dig into the mathematics of this stuff, but are you saying that consciousness and is potentially linked to the brain, or is consciousness something that's separate from our brain? Meaning, if we lose our brain, do we lose our consciousness?
Well, we do know as a matter of empirical fact that, for example, if you have a stroke in like area V4 of the left hemisphere, then you will lose all color experience in the right half of your visual world. You still see color in the left half of the world, but you don't see color in the right half. You just see shades of gray. So we know that there are clean correlations between brain activity and conscious experiences. So I'm not denying that. And there's hundreds of them. Brain activity is correlated with conscious experience. What I'm denying is that brain activity causes conscious experience. The brain is a user interface symbol that I think is telling us about, this is another aspect of the theory that I haven't talked about. Each agent, each conscious agent when you have agents that interact, they form new agents. So when agents interact, it turns out the mathematics says the dynamics of conscious agents interacting creates new agents. So you are not just one agent. You are two agents. You are four agents. You are a whole hierarchy, a whole network of conscious agents that you, and you represent that whole network in terms of your body and your brain. So your brain is just an icon symbol that's telling you about all these other agents that are interacting together to form the single top level agent that you call you. And gotcha. So the brain, but to be very, very clear, space and time don't exist apart from your perceptions. Space and time are just the format of your perceptions. So nothing in space and time exists apart from your perceptions. Nothing.
Right? Just to dig into that point, because the idea of you is interesting for me, because where I was going with that question is there's a common procedure. I don't know the name of it, but it's often for babies and very young children that are under the age of 3 that have seizures at very young ages. And you feel free to let me know what the procedure is called, but it's basically where they split and cut the brain in half.
Commissurotomy.
Right. What you said. And I guess the idea from a medical perspective is that it's so young where the brain is just starting to develop that they can live. They're basically cutting out the part of the brain, let's say the left part, that is causing the seizures, and they're allowing the right part of the brain to grow. And the idea is they're young enough where over time, when they grow up, they'll still be able to have the full functions of the brain. Maybe not the full, but at least to be livable. The theory that I have is if you were able to take the other part of the brain that someone took and put it into a different body, does that person now have two consciousness?
And you asked a really good question. So you're absolutely right that when we do surgery on the brain, it has specific and important effects that we can predict, say, on consciousness. And so the obvious question is, how does that fit into this whole theory that I'm talking about here? I mean, if I'm saying that the brain is just an icon, then how come when I cut the brain, things happen to consciousness, right? Doesn't that seem to contradict what I'm saying? And so think about it. Again, in terms of you've got a blue rectangular icon on your desktop, and I'm going to do a radical surgery on it. I'm going to drag it to the trash can. And when I do that, the file gets deleted. Now, is it the case that the literal movement of the pixels of that icon to the trash can pixels caused the file to be deleted? Well, no. That's just what I see on the desktop. So it's not the case that the movement of the icon to the trash can caused the file to be deleted. In fact, when I drag that icon to the trash can, I'm, as a normal user, I have no idea what I'm really doing in the computer, right? I'm triggering millions and millions of operations, and tons of magnetic fields are being changed and voltages are being toggled. I have no idea what I'm doing. But the end result is that, you know, maybe the file isn't erased. Maybe it's just, I can't locate it anymore, right? The file, the bits are still in the computer. Or maybe I erased it, right? Maybe you did a hard erase, and so you've really erased those magnetic fields from a drive or something. So that the key point is we see, even when we use the interface on our computer and we do something like delete a file, what we see on the screen is trivial, right? It allows us to delete the file. Yes. I mean, I dragged the blue icon to the trash can. I deleted the file. Do I really know how I did it? Absolutely not. Was the blue icon really critical? Well, only to guide my actions, but the blue icon is really irrelevant, right? It didn't really do anything. The thing that really happened is hidden from me. Same thing with the brain. So the brain, it is true that when we like damage area V4, we lose color. Damage V5, you actually lose motion perception in half the visual world. There's, you know, or I can take a TMS unit and stimulate a certain part of the medial temporal lobe, and some people will have a transcendental religious experience, right? So
I want that.
They'll say that they've been ushered into the presence of God, however they understand God. Yeah. So all of these things are true, but that doesn't mean that the brain is causing it. The brain, just like that blue icon symbol, or like the steering wheel in Grand Theft Auto, it's the right user interface icon to do certain. If I want to turn my car, use the steering wheel icon. If I want to accelerate, don't use the steering wheel icon, use the gas pedal icon. If I want to brake, then use the brake pedal. So there are different icons that do different things. But if you're a Grand Theft Auto player and don't know the computer science behind the software that's running it, you don't really know what you're doing. When you turn your wheel, you're playing the game, you're doing really well. You have no idea what you're really doing in reality. And so that's one really surprising thing from this whole thing that I'm saying. When you act in everyday life, picking up a fork, putting food in your mouth, shaking hands, hitting a tennis ball, you have your interface picture of what you're doing, but we never know what we're really doing in reality. I have no idea what I'm actually doing in objective reality. I can only see a depiction. So my hand itself is my hand picks up a spoon or picks up a tennis ball. All I know is my interface projection of what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm really doing. It's truly humbling. This point of view is really, really, so this point of view is, it's profound in the sense that, you know, space-time is gone. It's not fundamental. That's enough. But now I don't even know what I am, because my body is just an icon. I don't know what I'm doing. But I think the tools of science are up to the challenge. I think we can build models of objective reality, show how space and time and brains and bodies and physical objects arise as interface icons, and we can slowly work toward understanding what we really are and what we're really doing. I think that that's possible in principle, but it's not possible if we remain blinkered, if we just say space-time is fundamental, this is the truth. If you never are willing to remove the headset, you can never see what's outside the headset. We've got to be willing to remove the headset and really think outside of that box. That's the big one. Recognizing that this is just a headset. Every symbol inside of it is just a headset symbol. I've got to think about the reality outside this headset, how it gets mapped into the data structures that I see in my headset, like a steering wheel. What is it in the supercomputer that corresponds to the steering wheel? What is it in the supercomputer that corresponds to the gas pedal? Why is it that the gas pedal does this, the steering wheel does that in the game of life? That's like, why does the brain do this? Why does my hand do that? Why does a rock do this and so forth? Why does LSD do that? We have to be really sophisticated, because we have to reverse engineer them beyond the headset. What is the thing behind the headset that corresponds to LSD in the headset? What is the thing behind the headset that corresponds to a neuron? Once we get those correspondences, then we can begin to understand, what are we really doing when we eat food? What are we really doing when we pick up a ball? Right now, I have no idea what I'm really doing. It's true. It's a profound ignorance. but that it's truly stunning ignorance that we have.
This brings me to my next question, which is, are we living in a simulation?
Oh, good question. So there's something in what I'm saying that's similar to the simulation ideas that Nick Bostrom and others who have the simulation hypothesis, but there's something that's deeply different. So let me say what's similar and then what's deeply different.
What is the hypothesis? Just to clarify.
Right. So Bostrom and Nick Bostrom and others are suggesting that you know, think about us. We're getting to the point where we can build VRs that are pretty powerful, virtual realities that are pretty powerful. We could imagine that they could get so powerful enough that they are so realistic that we might be able to create agents that are conscious and that are taken in by their worlds. And so the idea might be that, look, maybe we are such simulated agents, right? So maybe there's a programmer in a different level of reality. There's some teenager with pimples but a nice laptop, and they've simulated the whole thing, and we're just their plaything. And maybe that teenager in their laptop is just the simulation of another brilliant hacker at a lower
just
level.
Keeps going and going
all the
and
way
going.
All the okay. way down. So you can imagine this going all the way down to some base level. So there's some first programmer, some the ultimate hacker at the bottom that's started this whole house of levels. And Bostrom and others would say, what is the probability that we're at the bottom layer of that? Very, very small. So if there is a whole bunch of simulations, we're probably not the base level. We're probably just somewhere in there. So we're probably, this is just a simulation is the idea. So what's similar in their idea to what I'm saying is, what they're saying is that this space-time and what we're seeing here is not fundamental. There's a deeper reality. And I agree with them. But here's where I disagree. They still adopt a physicalist framework for the whole thing. That base programmer at the very, very bottom, wherever that might be, is in some space and time and some physical world with its own Big Bang or whatever. So it's a physical world. I disagree with that. I'm saying physicalism is fundamentally false. Space-time is fundamentally doomed. Space-time does not exist fundamentally. That's just the wrong framework. Second thing I disagree with, they're assuming that a physical system like a computer, if it's programmed cleverly enough, can create consciousness or the illusion of consciousness. And I deny that. Now, why do I deny that? I have many brilliant friends and colleagues who have mathematical models where they're trying to start with physical systems and boot up consciousness. So, for example, Tononi and Koch have this integrated information theory model of consciousness where you start with physical systems that have certain integrated information theoretic properties, so certain causal architectures. If you have the right causal architecture with the right kind of integrated information, then that is either identical to or causes consciousness to emerge. But they've not been able to use that theory to even say what the integrated architecture is, the causal architecture is, for even one specific conscious experience, like the taste of a lemon or the smell of garlic. When, you know, I've asked Giulio Tononi a couple times over the years, and recently in the last couple, 3 years, I asked him, nice mathematical theory. So I'm interested in consciousness. So what conscious experience can you explain? Is there any specific conscious experience where you've given me the integrated information circuit for that conscious experience? So we can go test it. I mean, this is science after all. What, give me the specific prediction of a specific conscious experience with a specific architecture so we can go test it. And you can't. There is none. Not one. And this has been 15, 20 years that they've been working on it. Or there's Stuart. And by the way, these are my colleagues and friends. I mean, they're smart people. I'm not saying that the theories are dumb or they're dumb. These are brilliant, brilliant people. This is just a hard problem. So Stuart Hameroff, another great guy, friend, theory of microtubules, the quantum states of microtubules having a coherent collapse. And somehow that is identical with or creates conscious experiences. And again, I've asked Stuart in front of an audience and at conference, okay, Stuart, well, great. So what's the orchestrated collapse of microtubules quantum states of microtubules that say the taste of chocolate? Or can you give me anyone? Is there any particular experience now that you can tell me that what the orchestrated collapse of quantum statism. Can't do it. And that's where the state of play is. There's another one of idea that there consciousness is related to sort of global broadcasting properties of certain computer networks. So if you have some kind of global workspace or global broadcasting system, that somehow is equated to consciousness or creates consciousness. And again, my question there is, okay, great idea. It's a really intriguing idea. So what is the broadcast architecture or the global workspace architecture and precise states that are, you know, the taste of a lemon? What is that? And again, there's literally nothing on the table. So here's the big point. There is no scientific theory that starts with space, time, and matter that can predict even one specific conscious experience, not one. So the idea, and I think it's principled. I think this failure is principled. And the reason is we've mistaken the interface for reality. We've assumed.
What do you mean by principled again?
Principled means that it's not just because you're not smart enough, it's because you started in the wrong place. In other words, you will never get there. No, even though these guys have IQ out the wazoo, they're really, really smart. If you start with the wrong place, you just can't solve the problem. And they're assuming that space, time, and particles, matter, like quarks and gluons, protons and neutrons, is the fundamental reality. And that we can then somehow get them together in a complicated enough pattern, dynamics, so that you can create consciousness. And I'm saying that that's flawed fundamentally, because space-time is not fundamental and particles are not fundamental. They don't create anything. They're just interface. It's like trying to say, I've got these nice little pixels in my headset, and those pixels are creating all of reality. No, those pixels don't create reality. They're just a data format. You know, in that metaphor is the supercomputer with its, you know, megabytes of software and so forth. That's the reality. The pixels are just a data format that I use to simplify that reality. So the simulation hypothesis is still assuming that unconscious space, time, and matter is fundamental, and that somehow consciousness could be booted up from unconscious space, time, and matter. And I'm saying that I think for principled reasons that can never happen. On the other hand, consciousness, if it's fundamental, can use what we call space, time, and matter as just a user interface format. So it's straightforward to get space, time, and matter as just a user interface format. So starting with consciousness, I can get space, time, and matter, and I've got work to do to show in detail. I mean, I need to show that I can predict from the dynamics of consciousness. I need to be able to predict, say, the scattering amplitude for gluons at the Large Hadron Collider. I need to get it precise. I need to get scattering for all the different particles, gluon-gluon interactions, photon-electron. I need to get all those scattering processes to, you know, and decimal places before I should be taken seriously. That's what we need to do. So there's a lot of work ahead for me to do, and then I'll have lunch. But so there's tons of work. But the idea that you can start with space and time and particles and boot up consciousness, there's not one success there yet. Not one.
Right. So those people, I mean, you guys just have a different theory, it seems, but do all of you guys believe that there is a potential that we do live in a simulation? Just to go back to that?
I think among my neuroscience colleagues, most of my neuroscience colleagues are physicalists. So they'd assume that space, time, and matter are fundamental. The Big Bang was the origin of everything in our universe. And, you know, I think most of them would say the simulation idea is an intriguing idea, but not to be taken terribly seriously. So I'm just now talking about my colleagues in cognitive neuroscience, right? This is, I would say, just in my informal conversations with them, most of them think neurons exist whether or not they're perceived. Space and time exist. The moon exists, whether or not they're perceived. Neural activity causes our behavior. Anybody who thinks otherwise is sort of nuts. And all these correlations between neural activity, like V4 and color experience, V5 and motion experience and so forth, clear evidence, they would say, that brain activity causes our conscious experiences. That's the standard view. So you know, the simulation hypothesis is understood, but not taken too seriously. And my hypothesis is not taken too seriously. What I would say, 90%+ of my colleagues in neuroscience believe is, of course, the brain exists when no one looks. You don't need to look at neurons for them to exist. They exist anyway, just like the moon exists. And of course, neural activity causes all of our behavior. And of course, neural activity causes our conscious experience. That's, I would say, 90%+ of my brilliant colleagues, good friends. I mean, I love these people. They're great people, even though we disagree on this. That's the standard view. And my idea, you know, is definitely believed by less than 1%.
Is it possible that both exist, where the people that created the simulation formulated space and time in our world, in our simulation, but in their simulation and in their world, space and time doesn't exist?
That would be a version of simulation theory that I would find quite interesting. That would be different than what's being proposed, right? What's being proposed is a physicalist version, but you could imagine a version of the simulation theory in which the fundamental reality is not physical, is not space and time. In some sense, when I talk about conscious agents interacting to create new conscious agents,
yeah,
I am doing that. I'm saying that a bunch of agents work together, and together they instantiate this interface that we call space and time and physical objects. This is a cooperative product of a bunch of agents. They're creating this interface, and they're creating the symbol that I call my body and my brain. And so, yes, this space-time is emerging from something that's not spatial or temporal at all. And so I am saying, in some sense, this is a simulation, but it's a simulation of consciousness, not of some physical system.
Now, based on your perception and the theories that you have around this, you know, the fact that this isn't really reality as it seems, you know, how do you look at the afterlife? You know, why are we here?
Great question.
As, quote unquote, humans.
Well, the right answer is I don't know. Right. So I'll just put that right up front. And the right answer to everything is I'm probably wrong. That's just the scientific attitude, right? You go bold, you go precise, and you go humble, because you know, put it this way. We know that our best scientific theories to date are missing something fundamental. Space-time is doomed. So that means general relativity, special relativity, and quantum field theory, which is defined on space-time, there's something fundamentally at the core that needs to be fixed about those theories. So if that's the case for our best theories, then surely Hoffman's latest theory is going to be wrong too, right? That's just in the cards. But life after death. Here's an analogy to help see how I could think about it. Imagine that you go to a virtual reality arcade with a bunch of friends and you to play, say, virtual tennis. Like doubles or something like that, and you put on your headset and bodysuit, and you see your partner on your side and two people on the other side of the net, and you serve the tennis ball and you're playing for a while, and then one of your friends across the net, you know, Tom says, "Excuse me, I need to get a drink. I'll be right back." So Tom takes off his headset and bodysuit to go get a drink, and his avatar collapses on the court, on the tennis court. It is motionless. Well, it looks like Tom is dead. But Tom isn't dead. He just stepped out of that virtual reality interface. He's off getting a drink. If space and time are not fundamental, if space-time is literally just a data structure, a headset data structure that we use, then death could be nothing more than we see the avatar that's left behind. Their body is the avatar that's left behind when they step out of this interface. It's quite plausible. Now, I don't know that. So that's plausible. It can happen in my framework. It cannot happen in a physicalist framework, right? You are nothing but an assembly of atoms. And your consciousness is nothing but what your brain does. You know, the mind is what the brain does. When the brain doesn't do anything, the mind is not there. You're gone. So with physicalism, there is absolutely no survival after death. In this framework in which consciousness is fundamental, it allows for the possibility. Now, I don't know if the notion of a self survives, right? So consciousness survives, but what about the particular representation that I have of a me with my hopes and my desires and my loves and so forth? Does that survive? I don't know. I mean, for me, working within this framework, that will be one of the technical problems I would like. I mean, a very interesting technical problem, because we all have skin in the game, right? What does survive, right? And there is interesting work with near-death experiences. There was a panel by the New York Academy of Sciences last fall, where they had a bunch of medical doctors in the New York area and elsewhere who are dealing with people who have had no cortical activity for 20, 30, 40 minutes, and they were able to resuscitate them. And these people do describe, so this is not just like near death, it's called near death experience, but they literally were brain dead for half an hour. There was no EEG, just no EEG there at all. And they were able to bring them back. And these people routinely describe similar experiences of a tunnel, a light, a life review, and all sorts of things that happens to them. And again, as a hard-nosed scientist, I do not take any of this at face value, right?
Until you experience it, right? Even if I experience it, I can't take it.
I mean, I don't. As I said, I don't even know what I'm doing right now when I pick up a cup with my hand. I don't take that at face value as a scientist anymore. I literally don't know what I'm doing. My theory tells me I don't know what I'm literally doing in reality. So science is. We have to be. It's really interesting what we have to do as scientists. There's this balance between being so hard-nosed that you never learn anything, and so gullible that you believe everything, right? So how do we find that middle road? So how do we find what's credible? Normally what we try to do as scientists is try to get something where we have replicable experiments, where we can do it over and over and over again. And unfortunately, these first-person things are not like replicable experiments. It's not like I can do and repeat an experiment. These are more just stories, these are anecdotes, right? And I'm not. And on the other hand, I don't want to dismiss anecdotes. That's the thing. We need to take our ideas wherever we can get them. So we need to listen to these anecdotes. And if a lot of people are saying the same thing, take that very, very seriously. But we also need mathematical theories, right? If I can get a mathematical theory that predicts these anecdotes, now I'm starting to perk up a little bit, right? Now, okay, so now I've got a mathematical model that predicts these kinds of anecdotes. That's doesn't mean it's right, but the BS meter goes down a little bit, right? I need to give it more credibility.
What about like brain machine interfaces that allow us to be able to see? We actually had Dr. Moran Serfan, who's a neuroscientist, and he was talking about similar things where he thinks that the potential for people to be, you know, brought back to life through science and medicine for a temporary amount of time, you know, if they were hooked to a brain machine interface, would be able to do crazy stuff like be able to communicate with those people after they have, you know, so-called passed, and that would obviously change a lot of these different things. Could that help in some ways to be able to gather more data to understand what life after death could be?
In principle, it's quite possible, but right now I think these proposals we're really shooting in the dark, because we don't have a mathematically precise theory of what's beyond the interface, right? What's beyond space and time? And so it's very much like someone who you know, is a real good player at Grand Theft Auto, and they're trying to guess at how the software works and, you know, why the steering wheel does what it does and the brake pedal. Well, you can imagine that most of the guesses are going to be wrong, right? And until you actually, you know, understand the code, and there's going to be many, many hundreds of megabytes of code, perhaps, maybe gigabytes of code that's involved here, then you can begin to intelligently understand how, you know, the steering wheel and work, and also in this case, the example you give, how the brain works and how we might interface with it. So I'm not dismissing the possibility. I'm saying we've got a ton of theory to do before we can do that intelligently. We've got to reverse engineer the whole interface. Let me put it another example like this. So it's 1860 or something like that, and we've just discovered all these interesting things about electricity, say 1850. So we don't know exactly how it works, and there's no technology yet, but we realized that somehow electricity can do stuff miraculously across space and time. And so we think, okay, so this is the mystical thing. This is the mystical thing that can connect us. And maybe if we like have seances and hold hands, we can use this power to actually communicate with people on the other side of the world using electricity. Well, it turns out you're right that you can use electricity to communicate with people on the other side of the world. But it's going to take you a century of hard work and mathematical modeling to allow what you and I are doing right now. I'm in direct contact with you. You're in Spain. I'm in California. We're literally on opposite sides of the world. We're using electricity to do what would seem miraculous to people in 1840, 1850. But we didn't get there by holding hands. We got there through hard mathematical analysis, years and years of technology development of infrastructure, and now we can do it. And that's my guess is what's going to happen here is, right, I mean, you just can't leap there from here. We've got all this mathematical modeling to do. We have to understand the network of conscious agents, how it works, understand really what happens at death and this relationship to the interface. And then, yes, I don't see in principle why eventually we might not be able to open new portals outside of our interface to conscious agents. But the technology and the mathematics and the theories that are going to be involved to do that, I'm excited to work on it, but, you know, that's not trivial. Not trivial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, there are scientists that are claiming that, you know, there are black holes that exist in the universe. If you were to pass it, there are millions of other universes that could exist. And I guess one way to look at the idea of dying and then going into a different portal of the light means we just enter a different universe that's in a different black hole. Is that kind of the idea, roughly, that we're talking about? We just go into a different universe?
Well, the thing about black holes is the best theory that we have of them right now tells us there's a singularity at the center. When you go through across the event horizon of a black hole, space and time reverse roles. The arrow inward is now time, and the arrow points you to the singularity. What's really happening is that you're being sucked into a singularity where you're destroyed. So how you might you might be able to open up wormholes. There is some stuff going on about how you might be able to open up wormholes into other realms. I think that the state of play in black hole science is still, I mean, it's much more sophisticated than it was, you know, 100 years ago. But we don't even really know what happens at the event horizon, whether there's a firewall at the event horizon of black holes that burns you up when you go across or not. I mean, the real hot shots on this are really don't really know. So I'm not really proposing that kind of thing. I'm saying that there may be, just like your body, which is my icon, right? Because I'm just seeing the icon that I create, but I've got a portal to your consciousness. I can do certain things, and I can affect how you feel. I can affect how you think. It's truly a remarkable ability that I've got, and you've got the ability to affect me through a particular portal in your interface that you call the body of Don Hoffman, and I call the body of, you know, Sean Kim. So So using these portals, we can go back and forth. These are not black holes. These are just portals that we use in our interface that affect consciousnesses. So what I'm saying is, once we understand how the Sean Kim body icon works, the Don Hoffman body icon works as portals into consciousness, once we reverse engineer those kinds of portals, or my cat body, that seems to be a portal into a consciousness. Once we reverse engineer those, then we may understand how portals work, and we may be able to create new portals. And they may be utterly
new ones. Interesting.
Does that make sense?
Okay. Not really, but it's understanding within my realm and my pay grade. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how to do it yet.
Well, have any scientists ever thought that black holes were designed to only leave, not enter? Meaning their other side of the people, whatever universe that is in the black hole, could potentially enter our world, so-called aliens, but the whole thing was designed so that we can never enter that side of the world, meaning that is what's keeping it out?
I don't know if not too many serious scientists would be thinking that it was aliens that were designed.
I'm sure they're not. This is my dumb, fifth grade physics theory. This is just to get your brain sparks.
Yeah, no, I don't think that they're thinking that, but I do think they have a legit, and by the way, I'm not a black hole scientist, so, we would really want to talk to the real physicists, Roger Penrose, who just won the Nobel Prize this year for his work on black holes, and Goetz, who at UCLA, who helped discover the black hole at the center of our own galaxy. I mean, these are some of the real experts. But my understanding of the state of play on this is that some take wormholes seriously. Some take seriously the possibility of certain travel of microscopic things through wormholes. I think most are skeptical that macroscopic objects the size of human bodies can get through. But that, we would need new insights into space-time and new insights into the mathematics of black holes to make that kind of portal possible. I mean, I don't think anybody will rule it out a priori, but it's just that given our current understanding of black holes and so forth, it's not even clear that you'll survive the event horizon. I mean, you might get burnt up at the firewall there, but if you do get through, then there are debates about whether there is a wormhole that could get the microscopic particles through, or whether you get stuck halfway and die. Maybe you can't get all the way. There's all sorts of debates about that are beyond my knowledge right now of black hole science.
Yeah. And definitely beyond my knowledge. Don, I really appreciate your time. We covered so many different things, and I'm having trouble processing all of it, to be honest with you. I'm probably going to have to rewatch this multiple times just to kind of compute the information you just shared with me, as I'm sure as a lot of people there. Where can people find out more about you, and what are some of the exciting projects? I don't know if I should call it projects, but the next things that you're working on. I know you're retired now. Right. Congrats.
Right. Thanks.
And hopefully you'll have a lot more time to help us discover the black hole.
Right. Well, if people want to find out more, I've got a book for a popular audience, not a technical audience. It's called The Case Against Reality. So if you look up Hoffman, The Case Against Reality, it was published last year by Norton in the US, Penguin in the UK. So that's a good introduction to the evolutionary argument that I gave and how it works, and then also to consciousness and my ideas about consciousness being fundamental and network of consciousness. I've got a TED Talk. If you just Google Donald Hoffman TED Talk, it's called Do We See Reality As It Is? You can see my TED Talk on that. And if you just Google my name, there's a ton of podcasts and videos that are out there if people want to see that. It's really easy. I've got a Twitter account at Donald D. Hoffman. So if people want to follow me on Twitter, whenever I have a new videos come out or something like that, or I'll post a link on Twitter. So people, if they're interested, they can follow there. And, what I plan to be doing myself is very specific, working on this mathematical model of conscious agents, looking at the long-term behavior, what we call the asymptotic or long-term behavior. I want to prove specifically that the long-term behavior of that precisely gives a map to what the physicists are finding behind space-time, things they call cosmological polytopes, amplituhedra, sociohedra. The physicists are saying space-time is doomed. We're looking for structures behind space-time. I'm saying, yes, space-time is doomed. Consciousness is way behind space-time. And if I start with consciousness, I can meet you in the middle, right? You're going from space-time backwards to these, you know, like the cosmological polytope. I want to go from consciousness forwards to the cosmological polytope. If we can meet in the middle, it's like getting the Continental Railroad coming from the East Coast and the West Coast. If we can meet in the middle, then we can go all the way. And I would like to go all the way from consciousness through the asymptotics of consciousness, through the cosmological polytope, into space and time, and predict things at the Large Hadron Collider. If I can do that, doesn't mean I'm right, but it means at least it's worth taking seriously now. It's worth studying this. We now have a real candidate for consciousness on the table. It makes predictions that you can test at the Large Hadron Collider. Now we can find out where it's wrong. Right, and now it's worth trying to show that this is wrong. And of course I'll be wrong. Even if I can predict the Large Hadron Collider outcomes, that doesn't mean I'm right. It just means that we need to be more clever to find out where it's wrong. And that, so now we do science. We do precise predictions so we can figure out, test those predictions, figure out where we're wrong, and revise the theory. And now we get the whole process going. So of course I'm wrong. And my goal is to find out as quickly as I can where I'm wrong so we can continue to figure it out and revise the theory.
Right. Yeah. It seems like you're just unlocking this new platform, this new frontier that allows other up and coming scientists and current scientists and researchers to be able to really stand on so that they can do these experiments and dig into the details of what you have created as a foundation, which is awesome.
Right. Instead of science being near the end, it's just beginning. We're taking our first step out of the headset. So this is really good for job security for scientists. So scientists should be really grateful. This opened up a whole new vista. We're taking the first step out of the headset. There's everything to explore out there. So there's lots of work. So lots of job security for scientists. If you want to go into this, by the way, learn mathematics. More math, learn mathematics, physics, and neuroscience. And computer science. You have to know all of it. This is a multidisciplinary thing. So if someone wants to seriously do research in this area, I won't sugarcoat it. You need to know serious mathematics. I'm not just talking calculus. I'm talking about abstract algebra, information theory, category theory, topos theory. You need to know some serious math. You need to know serious computer science, and you should know your neuroscience backwards and forwards. That's what it takes. So this is no nonsense. Hard work ahead.
Yeah, we're just glad someone is there to do it, and someone that has the skill sets to do it. So, Donald, thank you so much. We'll link all of your info below. Of course, we'll hopefully get you back to make sure that we get any updates on the latest research that you found. And thank you so much for your time. Thank you guys for listening. Longest episode we've ever done so far, by the way. We usually just do 45 minutes to 60 minutes, but this is definitely worth it. So thank you guys again for listening. And thank you, Don, for coming on. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Sean.
Thanks for making it all the way to the end of the show. Hope you really enjoyed our guest today and that you took one thing valuable from our conversation. If you haven't already, I would love it if you could leave a quick rating or review on whichever network you're listening to the show and share this episode with one friend if you found it valuable. And if it's something that a friend, a family member, or just someone that you care about could find a little bit of insight from what you learned today. All right. Ciao.